at roughly $10 million a day deficit. We had to do something. We had to make some step forward.
Governor Walker proposes cuts to address the state's budget shortfall. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, VPSOs choose whether to go through training to carry a deadly weapon.
It's opened up that conversation for some of them to consider, you know, can I emotionally do that? Could I use deadly force on a person if I needed to?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. The deadline is March the 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
The latest iteration of the governor's budget cuts $136 million from the previous version, APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
Suspense around Governor Bill Walker's budget started growing on Wednesday. That morning, his budget director, Pat Pitney, announced details were on the way and warned the Senate Finance Committee the cuts would slash state spending by 9% over the previous year.
The public discussion just based on these reductions are going to be loud. This will not be viewed as low-hanging fruit.
A few hours later, an email from the governor went out to all state employees that alluded to layoffs and acknowledged the next few months would undoubtedly be a time of uncertainty and stress. Some legislators even stayed up until midnight, hoping to see the document. Agency spending details finally dropped at noon on Thursday. The proposal identifies more than 300 positions for downsizing, with a quarter of those jobs coming from the university system. The Department of Corrections loses $12 million with a cut to the community jails program. Grant programs and senior benefits also face cuts. At a press conference, the governor described the decisions as difficult but necessary.
At roughly $10 million a day deficit, we had to do something. We had to make some step forward.
With 24,000 state employees on payroll, the proposed layoffs amount to 1% of the workforce. About half of those positions are currently vacant. Members of Walker's cabinet have also discussed the potential for buyouts or retirement incentives for senior state employees, but still needs to conduct an analysis to see if that would make sense. When asked if further reductions are necessary, Walker described his budget as a starting point for legislators, but expressed concern that dramatic layoffs could have a ripple effect through the state's economy.
Could we have cut deeper? Of course. Could we have cut less? Perhaps. But it's that sort of surgical fine place to be to do it in such a way that we don't create the tailspin that some of we saw in the 80s.
Lawmakers are not expecting to have a good sense of the budget until Monday, after their finance analysts have had a chance to review the numbers. But House Finance Co-Chair Mark Newman, a Republican from Big Lake, says they will be looking at the budget with an eye for further cuts, given the drop in state revenue from low oil prices.
We have a $3.5 billion deficit, so we're going to go through that. We'll look at through the committee process, the discovery process that is, but I would expect some further reductions in that.
State employee unions are trying to take the cuts in stride. Jim Duncan directs the Alaska Bargaining Unit of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
Never satisfied with any layoffs, but you know, the 300 number doesn't seem to be all that large, but it's important, you know, for those people who might fall within that. It's a very critical situation.
Duncan adds that layoffs are not final until the legislature passes the budget and the governor signs it, and that the union has procedures in place for employees facing layoffs. Meanwhile, groups that advocate for smaller government do not think the cuts go far enough. Jeremy Price directs the Alaska chapter of Americans for Prosperity.
We're of the belief that the governor failed to take aggressive action and substantially reduce unrestricted general fund spending. And it's our hope that the legislature will have the courage to do what Governor Walker refused to do.
Walker has until February 18th to finalize his budget and says that adjustments are possible if the administration finds other potential cuts. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Village public safety officers in Western Alaska will be participating in a pilot program that could make them the first VPSOs in the state to carry weapons in their job. They're in the middle of psychological testing right now, and as KYUK's Ben Matheson reports, seven experienced officers have advanced toward training.
About a year after the Alaska legislature passed a law to allow VPSOs to carry guns, a handful of Western Alaska communities should have trained officers on the job with firearms. A pilot project to arm the first VPSOs has seven candidates in the middle of intensive psychological testing before they advance to training. Captain Andrew Merrill is the Alaska State Troopers commander of the VPSO program.
This pilot project is going to help us design, you know, to review the training process we're using, to look at our selection process, to determine whether it's too strict or whether it's too loose, and to figure out exactly what's going to work best to make sure that we're providing that safe service to our communities and to keep our VPSOs safe throughout the region.
In 2014, the Alaska legislature passed the law to allow VPSOs to carry guns in addition to a taser and baton. It was spurred by the death of a VPSO in Manicotic, Thomas Madole, who was shot and killed while unarmed. In many communities, VPSOs are the only law enforcement and work without backup. Four of the seven prospective armed VPSOs will be in communities served by the Association of Village Council Presidents, or AVCP, plus one each in Bristol Bay, the Interior, and Northwest Arctic Borough. Merrill isn't saying which communities right now, due to the intense pressure on candidates to succeed in evaluations. Merrill says they started with the best of the best for candidates. The VPSO, their community, and their nonprofit employer all have to agree to move ahead. To make it to training, candidates have to pass a physical test, which includes push-ups, sit-ups, and running, plus go through intensive background checks, pass a written psychological test, and an in-person evaluation with a psychologist. They're ultimately reviewed by a three-person panel of trooper officials who will make a recommendation to the colonel in charge of all state troopers about who advances to the firearms training. Officials plan a 21-day course in March at the Trooper Academy in Sitka for training on topics including weapons ethics, the use of deadly force, and various simulations. Merrill says that training on the use of force builds on years of preparing troopers for rural Alaska law enforcement.
You know, what options are available to use in different situations based on the totality of what's happening? How does that best apply to resolving the situation as safely as possible? Regarding the use of deadly force, it's governed by statute. I mean, you use deadly force in defense of yourself or another in either life-threatening or serious injury situations.
Troopers will play a key role in training. The VPSOs will use the same .40 caliber Glock pistol that troopers carry, and each VPSO will be paired with a state trooper for experience in an urban part of the state. The trooper will spend time in the VPSO's community for observation and training following their Sitka training.
Once we do that, we're going to roll through this project through the mentorship process and the observations and evaluation of how that's working. And the anticipation would be is that probably early next year, about the same time, we'll roll into the next class. And we'll do another transition course, maybe with some adaptations. Maybe we did it right. It'll be perfect. But we'll adapt it. We'll make it work. And then we'll go through that next cycle.
The program started with 21 candidates, but Merrill says 14 have dropped out due to personal reasons or not being able to meet physical fitness standards.
It's opened up that conversation for some of them to consider, you know, can I emotionally do that? Could I use deadly force on a person if I needed to? Some think they can, but they've also realized that the aftermath of that, of living in a small community of 300 or 400 people and knowing and being related to some of them, could be devastating. And so they've chosen not to participate at this time, and they may in the future choose to.
Alvin Jimmy is the AVCP VPSO program coordinator, the employer of YK Delta VPSOs. He emphasizes teamwork and collaboration over the coming months.
Working cohesively together as a team to establish the pros and cons towards it, and that's the best way to, from my perspective, to approach it is look at the pros and cons to it and start concentrating on these pros and so forth and move on with those.
The VPSO's anticipated graduation from the academy is April 3rd. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska fishermen have 3 years before the EPA is supposed to begin regulating deck wash, bilge water, and other liquids just discharged from small vessels. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski this week introduced a bill to permanently block the regulation for commercial vessels under 79 feet. Senate co-sponsors include Alaska's Dan Sullivan and California Democrat Barbara Boxer. The threat of the looming discharge regulation frustrates owners of commercial boats from Alaska to Florida. Robert Zales, president of the National Association of Charter Boat Operators, let his exasperation show in testimony at a recent U.S. Senate hearing.
How do I can't even give you an answer to that question on how much rain runs off my deck on any particular day. It's rainwater that would have hit the water if it hadn't hit my boat. So what is the purpose?
Murkowski and Boxer nearly won a permanent exemption for small boats last year, but owners of bigger vessels objected, saying the exemption should cover their ballast water discharge too. Boxer says ballast water poses more danger because it can carry invasive species from port to port. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, training a blind seal to follow commands.
And I asked him, let's go, so that's asking him to follow me where I am, and shook his little shaker, and he caught on to that and came right up.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska, offering passenger, cargo, and same-day package delivery to over 100 communities across Alaska. Find more at flyraven.com.
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, gives Alaska Native students the inspiration and opportunity to excel in science and engineering careers, building a sustainable future for Alaska. More at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The Glory Hole Shelter and Soup Kitchen reopened its doors Wednesday morning after plumbing repairs had closed down its headquarters for the last 2 months. KTOO's Kevin Reagan has more.
It's move-in day for Maria Lovashuk at the Glory Hole.
So it's going to kind of like go on an angle right here.
The executive director of Juno's nonprofit homeless shelter has not worked at a desk of her own since a broken pipe flooded the building 2 months ago.
The transition period will be over pretty soon. It's just really great to have the building back.
The shelter stayed in operation while its building was under repair. The Salvation Army and Holy Trinity Church helped the Glory Hole provide basic services to its regular patrons. Lovashuk says insurance covered most of the repair costs, and community donations allowed the Glory Hole building to undergo some much-needed upgrades. New cabinet panels, kitchen stove, and plumbing system were installed while the building was being serviced.
Fortunately, we have a lot of partners in the community and in the state, and because of the help of our great partners, it has not been as horrible as it could have been.
Just below Lovashuk's office, her staff is preparing to serve the first meal in the Glory Hole since the building went into repair. A crowd of about 20 quickly files in right at lunchtime.
Help yourself to a sandwich and a plate if you like one.
On the menu is homemade chili and Subway sandwiches.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Welcome back.
For Mike Davis, the chili isn't quite strong enough. He pulls out a container of garlic salt and sprinkles it on top. It's a ritual he does with all of his food.
Cold medicine. That's actually what it is. That just keeps you healthy.
Davis had been staying at the Juno International Hostel with other Glory Hole residents during the repairs. He doesn't plan to stay in the shelter for very long, but he's glad to see it reopen for those who have nowhere else to go.
I know it's really important for a lot of these people. They feel a lot more comfortable here. Sense of security, I guess.
The Glory Hole is capable of housing 40 people at a time in its dormitories, and residents have been moving back in for the last couple of weeks. With the building back in operation, Lovashuk says it should be easier for the Glory Hole to continue its involvement with developing the capital city's Housing First project to address chronic homelessness. In Juneau, I'm Kevin Reagan.
Of the 26 mushers signed up to race dog teams in this year's Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race, 10 are rookies. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, many of them might be new to the race, but a few have trained dog teams and worked for a handful of well-known and champion long-distance mushers.
When Yukon Quest veterinarians gave Kristen Knight Pace's dog team the green light following their pre-race checkup, The rookie musher breathed a sigh of relief.
I'm just ready to hit the trail. The preparation has been exhausting and comprehensive and taken over our whole life, you know, and it's like, it seems like all we've been doing is just preparing and preparing, and I just want to be on the runners.
Knight Pace of Healy both worked and trained with former UConn Quest and Iditarod champion Jeff King. She says she sought plenty of advice from King over the last year.
I'm pretty sure I was filling my quota of phone calls to Jeff.
She says the 1,000-mile race will be the longest distance she's ever traveled with a dog team in one shot. So even though she'd like to be competitive, it's likely she'll hold her team back.
You know, I'm also realistic, and I think part of being competitive is wanting to succeed. And in order to succeed, you have to cross the finish line. And in order to cross the finish line, at least for a rookie, I think you need to be pretty conservative.
Knight Pace's plan is similar to the one Two Rivers musher Ryan Olson is working on for her rookie Quest run.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of unknowns there, so it's kind of an exciting feeling. It's, you know, get to do something that I've never done before. I've never planned for a 1,000-mile race all by myself, and so, yeah, it'll be fun.
But Olson has helped plan other 1,000-mile sled dog races. She used to work with defending champion Alan Moore and three-time second-place Iditarod finisher Allie Zirkel. As part of that job, Olson drove a young team to Nome in 2012. She's also showed off a competitive edge in her mid-distance qualifying races, including last month's Copper Basin 300, where she placed third.
I'm very competitive. It's going to be really hard for me to take it easy on the dogs just because, yeah, especially when I get in the race setting, I want to see what they can do. I want to see what I can do.
Despite her resume, Olson says she'll also try to race conservatively, in part because many of her dogs are only 2 years old.
I'm hoping we'll be square in the middle. Definitely in the future, I want to try and be up there with the top front runners. But this year, just because they are so young, and while the Copper Basin was great and I'm so proud of them, it's just a totally different race. And I really want this to be a learning experience and a really positive experience.
A learning experience is what Damon Tedford is looking to gain from his race.
I'm like an official rookie. It's funny you should ask, because when I was filling out my form for the Quest, they're like, how long have you been mushing? And I just put like less than a year. And I had somebody on Facebook actually were like, less than a year? What are you doing attempting this?
Tedford is an emergency room doctor from Vancouver, British Columbia. He's running a team owned by Iditarod champion Mitch Seavey.
Just mush is kind of Mitch's line. Yeah, we kind of joke around the kennel about that. But yeah, you know, try not to sweat the small stuff. You know, if the dogs are running and they're eating and you're, you know, focus on looking after your dogs and not making mountains out of molehills, and just get out and have a good time. And I think that's, you know, it's the best advice anybody could give you.
Another rookie musher who's received decades worth of mushing advice is Ray Reddington Jr. He comes from mushing royalty. His grandfather is Iditarod founder Joe Reddington Sr. He's confident his team can hold up against competition he's faced in other races.
I think I could probably do okay, I guess, in it. You know, I don't know. I look at the field. I race against them all the time. They ain't any better. They just know, you know, where we're going.
26 dog teams will go west from Whitehorse. Over the next 2 weeks, they'll travel 1,000 miles along an old Gold Rush-era trail to cross the finish line in Alaska's Golden Heart City. For KUAC News, I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
A disabled harbor seal pup at Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward has learned a new trick. Bryce, the blind baby seal, responds to sound and voice commands. And as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, trainers are teaching him the behaviors that may help him find a permanent home.
The Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward normally cares for stranded marine mammals. 16 seal pups alone last year. eventually releasing them back into the wild. But something about the two-month-old harbor seal found on a Homer beach was different. Hallie Werner is the center's stranding supervisor.
We didn't actually know he was blind right away. He was showing all normal behavioral signs. His vet exam went great. And after a few days after his arrival, we noticed that he just wasn't looking at us right, or he wasn't looking at us at all, and we started seeing signs of a lack of vision.
Werner says veterinarians determined the two-month-old harbor seal was blind, probably due to head trauma. So Werner is training the seal to heed sound cues. She puts Bryce through his paces, and the little seal responds with enthusiasm.
So he knows when a session is ready to start. He actually knows that I always want him to be in the water when I start. So you might have noticed he was just kind of hanging out. I gave him some fish to reinforce him, and I asked him, "Let's go." So that's asking him to follow me where I am. And shook his little shaker, and he caught on to that and came right up.
She says the words target, water, and let's go are standard words used in training seals.
He definitely knows when he's doing what he's asked, he's going to get his food. So he likes to please.
Water.
Bryce, who's named after Utah's Bryce Canyon, lives alone in a pool within the center. He's been there 6 months. Bryce has only limited experience with other seals, Werner says, having spent most of his life in his private pool. Werner says the seal's recognition of words and sounds may help the center place him in a permanent home despite his blindness.
Well, I think that's kind of what makes him charming.
And he is charming. Bryce dips and dives in his small enclosure, occasionally hauling out to inspect a couple of playthings, a blue ball, and a pile of ice cubes left for him to play with.
So we're working towards placing him in a different facility where he can live peacefully and happily amongst other seals and other people.
For now, Bryce has a home. Although he's kept away from public viewing, Werner says it's the goal of the center to place every animal that cannot be released back into the wild. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A video of Bryce the blind baby seal is on our website, alaskapublic.org. A group of people in Juneau spend an hour every Monday practicing Tlingit. They bring dictionaries and flashcards, look at handouts, and do language exercises. But this isn't a class. The informal group meets at the downtown public library and was started by Tlingit language students who understand that learning the language also means teaching it to as many people as possible. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Seventeen people sit around a table practicing sounds of the Tlingit language. They're watching a YouTube video made by Hone or Lance Twitchell. He teaches Tlingit at University of Alaska Southeast and is a vocal proponent of language revitalization. But Twitchell's voice over the speakers is the only trace of a Tlingit language teacher in the room. The group was formed last spring, a result of a brainstorming session on how to bring Tlingit language and culture to the community in an accessible way. One of its founders, Richard Radford, has been studying Tlingit for 2.5 years.
We're all learners, and so it is kind of like a class of students getting to sort of call the shots.
Which means the group can go in many different directions.
Anybody can share pretty much anything. We learned how to introduce ourselves in Persian a little while ago from someone coming in. We're really open to that. Multiculturalism is really a big part of this.
Radford says the group relies heavily on books, dictionaries, YouTube videos, and handouts made by more experienced Tlingit speakers.
There's elders and linguists and artists and culture bearers and professors and other language learners and all sorts of people from all over the place who provide us with so much. We're just standing on the shoulders of giants.
The group is made up of regulars and others who drop in because they're curious. At age 56, Nancy Keene has made it a goal to learn Tlingit. Her grandfather was fluent, but her mother never spoke a word. Keene's been drumming and singing clan songs for Southeast dance groups for 5 years, and that spurred her interest.
You have to want to know what you're singing about, and you have to want to know that you should pronounce this stuff correctly, because the language is just so subtle in nature that it's really easy to say something wrong when you don't mean to.
Tlingit is a tonal language. Similar-sounding words that mean drastically different things are distinguished by an inflection of the voice. The group practices these similar-sounding words.
Each.
Each.
Means reef, while
each.
Each.
Describes something compact and heavy. Keen says she can't put full sentences together yet, so she's working hard on memorizing sounds and pronunciations. She appreciates the group's passion for making the Tlingit language so available.
There was a lot of talk about building language nests, and now it's starting to actually come to light that they're making it available to people. And so that's how we're going to make sure we can continue and nurture this language.
The end of the hour comes quickly.
So if anybody wants to stick around and do some extra stuff for another, I don't know, 5 minutes or so, there's some stuff that we can do that's kind of more interactive.
David Shakely is running an exercise called Total Physical Response, or TPR.
Instead of just listening to the words and saying them back, you actually have to act them out with your body. And then so it makes connections between your muscles and muscle memory with what you hear and then also with what you say. First thing, get a han.
Get a han.
Get a han.
Stand up.
Get a han.
Gnu.
Gnu.
Get a han.
Get a han.
Shakely's family on his father's side is all Tlingit. Many of them spoke the language and helped spread it. Now, Shakely sees it as his responsibility. Like Keen and Shakely, many in the group are Alaska Native. Radford is not one of them.
I'm definitely European descended. There's the term Tlitka that gets used sometimes.
But as someone living in Alaska, he feels a responsibility to learn the local language.
We live in a very multicultural state. And sometimes people lose sight of that, myself included. I mean, we live in Tlingit Ani, and I think that we should be learning the language of this place.
Gnu.
Gnu.
Gnashchish. Gnashchish.
After the exercise, the group session ends, but the conversation carries on. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Bethel, Kevin Reagan and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail, and Ellen Lockyer in Seward. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Artist, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. The deadline is March the 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.